Good morning. The Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue is open, and we welcome our House colleagues here, and especially Representatives Reske and Findley for the first time here. I think this is their first economic forecast that we're here. So welcome, gentlemen. Let's get right to it and start off with our economic forecast release with Mark and Josh. And excuse me. I should remind everyone to refresh OLIS after they start so that the new documents will appear online.
Hey, how are you today, madam?
Who's your witness?
Thank you, Chair Haas, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark McMullen, Oregon State economist, joined as always by my colleague, Josh Lehner. So I'm sure it will come as no surprise to all of you, but after very long economic expansion, 8 years and some 30-some revenue forecasts, sometimes Josh and I have trouble or struggle to put together a presentation that gets across the main important points but still keeps it fresh, because you know, a lot of the things haven't changed here for quite some time. But that said, we have to be careful what we wish for, because this time that was not a problem. Since over the last few weeks, we had really two seismic events in terms of the revenue forecast that are changing the outlook pretty significantly, and that's what we're going to focus on today. The first being the passage of the Tax Cuts and Job Act at the federal level, which has a myriad of impacts on the state budget, and the second being a correction, or at least the beginning of one, in equity markets, which our revenue system, being dependent on personal income taxes, is particularly sensitive to. And so most of this today's presentation will be talking about the conduits and the channels by which these feed into our revenue outlook. But to start, Josh is going to go ahead and give a quick overview of where we are in the business cycle, which hasn't changed a whole lot since our last meeting.
Thanks, Mark. Chair Haas and members of the committees, for the record, Josh Lehner, economist, Office of Economic Analysis. Right now, overall, the economy is doing well. As Mark said, we're clearly into the mature phase of an expansion. Economists don't believe we're into the late stages of an economic expansion. All of the data flows, all the leading indicators that are out there are continuing to flash green. The outlook in the near term is positive. Economists overall are pretty sanguine about the probability of a recession. If you look at the Wall Street Journal consensus of forecasters, there's about 60 of them that answer that's in this data set. You know, they say it's maybe about 14% probability of recession in the next year, given the healthy data flow, and then, of course, some of the policy changes that have gone on in the last couple of months. The other good news is, after a financial crisis, which takes a longer time to heal from, it's a more severe recession, it's a slower path moving forward coming out of it, we're finally back to potential GDP, the amount of stuff we're producing, given the amounts of workers we have in the workforce, given the amount of capital and plants and equipment and software and technology that's in the economy. We're finally back to producing at capacity, at least according to the most recent estimates of potential GDP in the economy coming from the Congressional Budget Office in D.C. Private sector forecasters, very much similar type of estimates, where we're back to producing as much as we think we can do. However, it's important to point out that this estimate of potential GDP that we're looking at today is very much a beaten down estimate relative to where we thought we could be pre-crisis, and even where we thought we could be a couple years ago, right? As this slower growth has materialized, maybe some of the damage from the recession we think is permanent and can't be reversed, given we've been in expansion 8 or 9 years now, maybe the productive capacity of the economy is even less than we thought. And a big important point here is productivity, the amount of output or product we're producing per worker or per unit labor, per unit of labor is dragging. It's perked up a little bit in the last year, but it's still lower than it has been historically. And so when you combine a slowing economy due to demographics and a slowing economy because productivity growth has been tampered down considerably in the last 10 to 15 years, our productive capacity might be less than we used to think. And so, but this chart's important to keep in mind is given where we are today versus where we think we could have been a few years ago, there might be more room to the upside, and the risk might be skewed toward the upside that if we run the economy hot, if we can maintain a very tight labor market, put in some fiscal stimulus and some other policies that could revive productivity, hopefully, we can shift this long-term potential upward like we saw a few years ago. And if we could do that, if we could unlock productivity growth, if we could raise potential GDP substantially above our current estimates, then future growth and translated into future revenue for the state of Oregon would be considerably higher, and the long-term economic outlook would be less of a concern than maybe it is today, given some of those long-run trends we've seen in the economy. And as we start to hit capacity, we start to run into some supply-side constraints. The biggest one and the most immediate one coming to mind and at the forefront of every business in Oregon today is labor. The labor market's tight. Here we're looking at the share of prime-age Oregonians, 25 to 54 years old, that has a job, right? How many, not the unemployment rate, but the how many of them actually have a job, and we're back to where we were a decade ago, right? The share of prime working-age Oregonians that are employed, and this is not just in total. This is by every educational attainment group, too. Those without a college degree, those with a college degree, those without a high school diploma. Every group is back to where they were a decade ago, but we're still below where we were in the 1990s, right? So again, if we can get some better growth or an expansion that continues for at least another couple of years, maybe we can get these employment rates back up to what we saw in the late 1990s. Again, this would increase the productive capacity of the economy and provide better long-term growth. You put all of this together in terms of where we are in the cycle and some of the impacts from the federal legislation, which we're about to dive into here in just a second, and we're looking for ongoing growth in the near-term outlook and a little bit above what we expected a couple months ago. There's a couple offsetting factors here. We're actually tracking low when it comes to employment in Oregon for the last 6 months. Job growth has come in. It's still positive, but it's come in below expectations from our office. So we're tracking a little bit low when you factor on a little bit stronger economic outlook. Look, in part due to some tax reform, we're looking at a relatively unchanged forecast. So those blue bars in the future are maybe a little bit stronger than they would have otherwise. However, we're starting from a somewhat lower base. And so on net, we're still expecting positive economic growth here in Oregon, positive revenue growth, but somewhat unchanged relative to 3 months ago because of those offsetting factors. One last point before we dive into the federal policy is in the last quarterly forecast, a couple of you asked for requests to talk on a couple different topics, one of them being migration and some discussion of flows into Oregon, and the other one being on homelessness and the impact with homeless students, and overall, what is the impact from the housing market and the economy and things like that. And we have not forgotten you, just given the breadth and discussion surrounding federal tax reform. We're putting that off until next quarterly forecast, and we'll revisit these conversations at that point in time.
Thanks. So how do we make sense of this, particularly the complicated tax reform and federal tax reform? How do we incorporate this into our quarterly forecast? So we mentioned some of these comments before the Senate committee earlier, but the starting point for our forecast are the piece-by-piece or provision-by-provision revenue estimates that are put together by the Legislative Revenue Office with a considerable amount of support from the Department of Revenue's research team. LRO has to look at a lot of these, particularly to inform you all, the policymakers, when they're trying to decide what to do about or whether or not to respond to the federal law, what things to reconnect to or to disconnect with and the like. And so it's very important for us to be on the same page in terms of this initial starting point with the Legislative Revenue Office's estimates, because should legislation be passed that, as I say, disconnects or reconnects or what may be with or changes the impact of these federal provisions, the legislature going to expect to see the resources that they've been debating over. So if LRO scores this particular provision as $100 million to the plus, and it passes, the legislature expects to see $100 million in the forecast. And so that's our starting point. We like to, try to stay on board and as informed as we can about as many of these provisions as we can. But in terms of the overall revenue forecast, unfortunately, the piece-by-piece analysis doesn't tell the whole story. That when you look at the package as a whole, there are all sorts of dynamic or behavioral effects that these things can have on the actors in the economy or tax practitioners or the like. As the rules of the game have changed, and so what we see the players of the game, workers and firms and accountants and the like, responding to that. And so part of our task is then to fold in some of the most important feedback mechanisms and dynamic effects into these static impacts that we start with from the Legislative Revenue Office. Of course, the economy being a big one. What's going to happen in terms of tax cuts and what do they do to the economy? To what extent are we stimulating the economy with deficit spending? Most the traditional economic model says that, well, geez, if you're going to raise the deficit by $1.5 trillion or $1 trillion, whether it be through tax cuts or spending, that would typically give you some at least short-term juice for growth. And then later on, as you see higher debt loads and interest rates are higher, it may drag and pull from growth going forward. So we're going to talk a little bit in detail about, those economic conduits. And, there are further conduits as well. What are the Fed policy reactions? Or what are firms going to investment reactions or workers and their labor force reactions? And so we're going to talk a little bit in detail about the most important channels in terms of how this works back through the economy, which then again, in the next order of business affects the revenues that are our prime directive. And we're also going to spend quite a bit of time talking about tax planning, not just the economist's factor, but to what extent do the changing rules cause people to file their taxes differently or file the taxes at different times, or to what extent are taxpayers moving around money, either changing the color of money or changing the timing of that, which also certainly affects us over the business cycle. So where do we start? Well, we start with static impacts. These are the most recent we have from Legislative Revenue Office, which is adding up all the provisions they have looked at for the Tax Cuts and Job Act, and separating them out into personal income taxes, the red bar, and corporate excise taxes, the blue bar. So these are differences from the baseline due to the imposition of the Tax Cuts and Job Act. So as you see here, right up front, it's a hit for both. Personal and corporate income taxes are down significantly in the first year, and then over time these negatives become positive. And this is a little a little bit surprising for some. Most states expected quite a bit of a windfall from this, even in the early stages. But the peculiarities of the Oregon tax code, which you guys have been diving into for some of the bills that I see you're debating, in Oregon, have led to some negative upfront costs, resource hit, that is. So why do we have this pattern where revenues are down today and up tomorrow? Well, there are quite a few factors that are all playing in. I've listed four here that are particularly important. Accelerated depreciation. Or expensing, which is accelerated depreciation taken in 1 year, both for corporations, C corporations, and pass-through entities, have been allowed to go ahead and take the costs of property expenditures right up front, rather than depreciating them over time. And so, what does that do? Well, it lowers the taxable income right away. But then, over time, if that's already been paid, that, or that rather, those costs have already been deducted over time, then we see an increase over time. We also see increases over time due to new inflation factors and the fact that the individual provisions expire. Yes, Senator Haas.
Senator Boquist, did you have a question?
Yeah, I did, please, if you would, Mr. Chair. Mark, would you just clarify the blue line in the first biennium there, which is the corporate line, that's directly connected to the repatriation. I believe that's connected to the repatriation down there, which is Senate Bill 1529, which we, the Senate, just sent to the House, right? Isn't that that line? For the most part.
Yes, Senator Haas, Senator Boquist. There are the two biggest factors in that are the accelerated depreciation and the repatriation.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for the clarification.
It would be the two biggest negative factors that are pulling it down. The repatriation is a little funky. You guys have been working on that, and because of the quirky Oregon tax law, for us, that's a negative instead of a positive. Because firms are allowed to take a double deduction here, which is a little technically odd, but you guys are working on that, so I won't dive too deep into that today. But that has the same sort of, whether positive or negative, the same sort of impact. If we go ahead and pay, the repatriation piece is multinational corporations have been required now to take income that they've been storing off-seas and deferring tax payments on it to bring it all onshore and then get it taxed at preferential rates. And so to the extent that these incomes would have been brought back, some of it onshore over time, then, you know, if this is all brought back at once, then that flips the revenue estimate going forward. So in our case right now, under current law, we start with a negative hit and becomes positive in future years. So this, everything you'll see from now on, I did mention now current law, I need to reiterate that our forecast is based on current law. So right now, it assumes that there is no change to the repatriation or the dividend received deduction, which is where you're working on the repatriation piece in Oregon law and the like. Right now, until the bills are passed by the legislature, we're not going to put them into this forecast. So you can think about the revenue impact estimates that legislative revenue staff is putting together as the deltas that you were going to get to this to our outlook should legislation be passed.
Mark? Excuse me, Senator Bertschinger.
So let me get this clear. This is a reflection of what is currently going on. Senate Bill 1529 passes the legislature, that will change. Am I getting that right?
Yes. Correct, Senator. Now, I haven't been following all the provisions, but one of them would be this, for example, would be this dividend received deduction for the repatriation piece. So if that one passes, it goes from a negative 80 hit to a positive 160 or something like along those lines. And so that's a significant swing in revenue of 240 would be in addition to what we're presenting today.
So the blue line would be above.
Or close to flat, I think. Chris would know better than I
would be above.
It would be above. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Senator Bertschinger referred to the repatriation piece, which I think you've been talking about as well. We only get that once, don't we? I mean, assuming we fix the statute so that it doesn't have a double deduction effect, which is what this reflects, assuming we fix it and it actually produces a small amount of net positive revenue, that money only comes in once because that repatriation money is only required by the federal law to come in once. Have I understood that correctly?
There are timing issues, but you are correct. It is certainly a one-time revenue. However, the federal provision allows for you to pay the taxes on it over 8 years. So, you know, how those tax revenues come in is a little bit of an open question, but the liability comes in all at once. And so for us, it's certainly a one-time event.
Well, may I, Mr. Chair? Thank you. So while we're on that topic, I'm guessing that the actual revenue impact of the Senate bill that we just were talking about is problematic, on timing at least, based on when the money might actually come in. Is that accurate or not?
Representative Barnhart, Senator Haas. It is accurate just insofar as the interplay with the kicker law. Typically, money early is better than money late for an economist, but rather have it today rather than tomorrow. Right. So more money is not a problem for the typical state. In Oregon, depending on where we land after two Aprils, that this could play into the kicker law, because technically the way the kicker works is we set that threshold in stone in May of the odd years after the close of session forecast, and then any special sessions or even year sessions which weren't in the picture when they passed the kicker law, any of those actually just are treated like manna from heaven.
Did that answer your question?
No, I actually was trying to ask a different question. You indicated the federal law allowed payment of this catch-up tax over time. Would Oregon law, under the bill that the Senate passed, also allow for that, or would it all come in immediately?
I believe
in
it
Oregon.
Would come in immediately.
Immediately.
Yes.
Immediately. Thank you. That was really the question I was asking.
Oh, sorry.
Of course,
yes,
to get back to your kicker point, in the corporate kicker, that money flows into a education account rather than back to the businesses. So we don't lose it in future biennia. The money's available in future biennia.
That's right, Representative Barnhart. That's correct.
Thank you.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just clarity, and I was trying to drive at, and I appreciate the line of questioning that Representative Barnhart had, because it was just wanted to make sure we'd done the right thing. But you did make the statement that it is one-time revenue, and this is, the forecast is now based on, will be based once we get past this starting point, on present law. My understanding is of course, the one-time revenue, the blue line, just for simple equation up here, the repatriation, does cover the funds from 1986 to now. But however, in the future and in future tax filings, all that overseas revenue will come back on a yearly basis, and you've melded that into your forecast.
Correct.
Great, right. Thank you.
Senator Birdsager.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, so what I'm gathering is 1529 would significantly affect the 1719 biennium and not the rest. The rest would pretty much look the same.
Yeah, from the impact statement I've seen, yes. There isn't as much of an impact in the out years.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so this is certainly the starting point, and like I say, we try to at least piece by piece be as consistent with these estimates as we can. Of course, once anything is passed into law, or once we actually start to see data on this, then we can, at that point, once we actually get some real world information, then we go ahead and adjust these. But for a starting point, this is where we start. And so what about these dynamic effects, right? When we start to add in some of the impact of maybe some faster near-term economic growth, maybe some shifting across tax years and some changing of taxpayer behavior, well, in general, this is going to work to mute this somewhat, particularly in the early stages. And some of these revenue declines that are called for in the static look are not as bad when we consider consider some of the behavioral responses to this. So in general, though, the first question you usually get is, well, so what if there were no Tax Cuts and Job Act? Would the revenue forecast be up or down? And that's actually a harder question to answer than you would think. My gut says probably be a little bit up. Right now we're seeing, unfortunately, we don't have a world to observe that where there isn't a Tax Cuts and Job Act. And we've already started to see a lot of responses to this, and so it's hard to net that out of our observations. To be specific, coming into this forecast, we're running a little bit behind on the economic forecast. That is, our forecast is a little stronger than actual job gains and wage gains that we've been seeing in the last 3 months since we met with you all. So that would suggest a lower forecast. But at the same time, we're seeing revenues track a little bit higher than we expected last time you saw, which would offset that. And more, in fact, a little bit more than a little bit. They are quite a bit higher. But the problem is some of those might not reflect true economic activity or liability. In particular, we've seen this real huge surge, as have most other states, at the very end of tax year 2017, where personal income tax filers were making huge estimated payments, corporate filers were making big, big advance payments, and firms were paying out big bonuses that were showing up as withholding. So all of this extra revenue, which is hard to differentiate for us, how much has to do with maybe underlying stronger economy than we expected or stronger revenue trends than we expected, and how much just has to do with responses to this, some of which will just go away in future years, is an open question. So it's hard to say, well, what would happen if we didn't have a Tax Cut and Job Act, because our data has it in there already, and it's already polluted what we're looking at.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. First, a comment on what you just said. I think you're referring to SALT, the SALT deduction issue. People make quarterly payments, make them in December, and will be able to get a tax deduction for state and local taxes on the 17 return, which they won't get in 18 because of the SALT limitation. So it's a tax planning tool, I think you're referring to when you make the last comment you made. The question I had really has to do with the other issue, which is Oregon is continuing to grow like crazy. I mean, we have a growing population above almost everybody else, and that's a factor in increased revenue, isn't it, over time? I don't mean this year, but over time.
Yes, two questions. The second one with the population growth, absolutely. I should be more careful about differentiating. Here we're talking about the deltas and how the forecast is changing relative to 3 months ago, not whether it's growing or shrinking. And so, yes, we overall our revenues are still growing faster than the typical state. Population growth has a lot to do with that. The SALT deduction one is a big I don't know. You know, that is one where it was highly advertised in a lot of states that you got to do this. In New York, they even passed a law, said, okay, we're going to allow this prepayment of state and local taxes to, you know, get out in front of these caps on the state and local income tax. And New York has seen even more than we have in terms of year-end estimated payments. They've seen a surge, but ours is pretty darn big too, and ours is just right there with the median state in terms of this big surge of estimated payments. But in Oregon, we don't allow the prepayment of state and local taxes, and the Department of Revenue has tried to communicate this. So I don't know, are our taxpayers just naive, or are they getting out in front of other provisions than the state and local tax provision? Or the like, you know, and so or is it fundamental growth? So this is one of the things that we've really been wrestling with to try to explain the recent observations.
Senator Boquist, and then we need to get off the starting point, closer to the finishing point.
Well, Mr. Chair, the finishing point could be something none of us like here, so I think we better ask questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, I just want you to clarify, Representative Barnhart did raise a very good point, but nothing in your economic analysis in terms of quarterlies, forecasted payments, so on and so forth. Obviously, the biggest piece is property tax, and none of that's in any of these calculations you have, because property tax is not paid in a quarterly or an estimate or anything. Correct.
Yes, Senator Boquist. Thank goodness property tax is not in the general fund. I have to talk to Dave Monroe about that one. Moving on. So what about the first big dynamic effect, the one that we know the most about, which is, well, how does tax cuts or stimulus feed into the economic growth or the economic performance in Oregon. And there's certainly some stimulus, but maybe not the best. And Josh is going to talk about how it's probably not the ideal timing or the ideal composition necessarily if you want to spur near-term growth. But nevertheless, we are going to get some.
Thanks, Mark. First, these are just the straight budget numbers coming out of the Joint Committee on Taxation. We're talking about, you know, how large are these tax cuts over the next decade. And the three things I'd like to highlight is we're going from 2017 to 2018, right? We're getting about $100-150 billion in tax cuts at the federal level. These are all those categories combined, personal, corporate, and international components. That's juice to the economy, right? That's deficit finance. Tax cuts should lead to larger economic activity, more spending, more investment, all that sort of stuff. As you go from 18 to 19, we're going up to closer to $300 billion in tax cuts, and that's more juice to the economy, right? That tax cut's increasing both this year and next year, so that should spur economic growth a little bit, given the standard economic theories and models. However, from 2019 onward, those tax cuts get a little bit smaller each and every year, so that actually acts as a restraint on growth to by and large when it comes to growth accounting. Even though there's still a tax cut in place, it's getting smaller over time for a variety of factors. As Mark talked about, you know, why is the revenue down today but up tomorrow? It's because of that timing issue with the expensing and the bonus depreciation, and then obviously as you get in the outer years, the income tax provisions expire entirely and actually turn negative, right? And so that last year we're seeing an increase in taxes given the current federal legislation. Now, of course, some of these provisions might be extended, you know, in 5 years and things like that, but that's not in the current baseline. So again, we're getting tax cuts this year, and the tax cuts in 2019 is even larger. Turning that into some sort of macroeconomic impact, what is that going to do to growth? The next slide has a couple sets of numbers coming from probably the two most commonly used or cited macroeconomic vendors in the U.S. IHS Market, which used to be IHS Economics, which used to be Global Insight, which, you know, they merged and bought out some competitors and things like that. But that's the major vendor across the U.S. and the one we subscribe to for a lot of our, you know, 30,000 foot view macroeconomic forecast that we use in our modeling. And they're showing where you get a little bit of juice to the economy in the near term, 0.1, 0.2, 0.3% growth in GDP above and beyond what was already in the baseline economic outlook. Moody's Analytics is a little bit more volatile, a little bit stronger in the near term, but a little bit more negative in the medium term as those provisions start to expire and the tax cuts get smaller over time. But they're largely telling the same sort of story, is that we're getting a little near-term boost to growth, then a little bit of a drag on growth, and over the longer term, not a lot of impact. Why is that, right? There's at least a few reasons why most economic forecasters believe this is the rough policy path or the rough impact of this policy. The first and foremost would be the timing in the business cycle. Where are we in the business cycle relative to implementing some sort of fiscal stimulus? Regardless of whether you think the stimulus is the right tool to use or not, or the way you design the cuts or the spending, you know, this point in a business cycle when we think we're approaching full employment or we think we're approaching current estimates of potential GDP, you get less bang for your buck. You'll maybe get more crowding out where the government spending just kind of pushes to the side some of the private activity. Maybe it'll materialize in inflation, and so that would be another reason why maybe the stimulus at this point in the cycle would be a little less effective than maybe during the depths of a recession, is if we do get more inflation, the Fed will step in and raise rates faster than expected. You raise interest rates faster, you're going to choke off some of that growth and mute some of these direct effects overall. So that'd be two of them, the point in the cycle, the Fed policy response. A couple other reasons why we might get a little less bang for your buck given the current legislation than maybe some alternate legislation has to do with the design of this particular policy. The first and foremost would be the temporary nature and the expiration, right? Again, we get a little near-term growth, but then we're taking that all away and actually increasing personal taxes in the long run. So therefore, that will be a drag on growth over the next 10 years. And then the other one would be coming from the design of the policy is who's getting the tax cuts, right? We're giving some to corporations, a large chunk of it to corporations. In fact, the permanent chunk is going to corporations. And if you look at a lot of the corporate indicators that are out there, particularly for the big multinational firms, they already are flush with reserves and flush with cash, and they have high profits. So access to capital, by and large, doesn't seem to be a major issue holding back their investment opportunities in recent years. And so adding more cash or more profits to these firms, is that really going to spur investment over the near term and the longer term? Possibly, right? Maybe it possibly will, and hopefully it will, because then we could raise that productive capacity of the economy. However, given their current balance sheets, maybe you get a little less bang for your buck again today. And then, of course, on the income tax side, we know, you know, that with you have tax cuts that are tilted towards higher income households, they will save some of their money. They don't live, you know, they don't spend entirely all of their money. And so if they're saving some of it, that's less spending going on in the economy in general relative to you give it to somebody who will spend 100% of that tax savings. So those four things combined sort of work to mute this. And even though they're muting some of the impacts due to the tax legislation, we're still saying above and beyond that, there will be economic growth in the near term faster than previously expected. And if in the next slide kind of shows some other studies above and beyond, you know, Moody's and IHS, some of the other studies that have been out there, what is their impact on the economy? And this table sort of a literature review, and it focuses on long-term growth or what's going on in 10 years or 20 years from now. And you can see up there the takeaway here is a lot of these numbers are relatively small. And that, again, that has to do with the way the legislation is written, that the long-term impact is relatively muted. The one thing I would highlight here is the bottom section, those bottom four where they model the corporate rate. A lot of the focus from some of this academic literature focuses on the relationship between corporate taxes and worker wages, right? And it's important to point out here that the way the literature lines up and the way the studies talk about this is a reduction in corporate taxes does not mean a corporation immediately turns around and hands a portion of that savings to workers. It's corporations take that tax windfall or that savings, and they invest it in new equipment and new plants and new technology, and it creates a more productive workforce and workers that are more productive and have a higher productivity then earn higher wages. That is the typical economic channel that the literature lays out, and it's spelled out quite clearly in the bottom estimate here from the Trump administration's Council of Economic Advisors. They have a white paper they put out in the fall about reducing the corporate tax rate, right? This is the case that they're making, right? This is the case that all economists would make when it comes to corporate taxation. This is very much a medium to long-term outlook. It takes at least a couple years for a corporation to receive reduced tax savings, to invest it in a new plant or a new equipment or something like that, to get a more productive workforce and things like that. So it's a multi-year process. And so that's just something to highlight. But the literature also says that there will be a relative boost to workers' wages in that medium to longer term if you get the investment. So the biggest question now is are we going to see larger business investment? Hopefully so. But, you know, we'll wait and see on some of those aspects.
Senator Burchard, go ahead.
Yes. When you look at this analysis, do you take in consideration, it's obvious that we're going to have a worker shortage, a workforce shortage going forward for quite some time, just the demographics. When you have a workforce shortage, wages automatically go up because corporation is not going to hang on to their employees if they don't have incentives, because they're going to go across the street and go to work for somebody else that will. So have you taken that in consideration when you talk about workers' wages going forward?
Senator Haas and Senator Bershinger, absolutely. We have a stronger wage. We have a relatively strong average wage forecast built into our forecast overall due to the tight labor market. And I didn't highlight and talk about all of those things on the slide earlier when we talked about the tight labor market, but absolutely, that's a big influence. And the other big influence here, and I think Mark will talk about this in just a second, is to the extent that maybe juicing the economy via fiscal stimulus at this point in a business cycle, we're able to wring out that last bit of labor slack, get that last 2 or 3 percentage points of prime age workers, prime working age individuals back to a job, you know, that is tremendously valuable. And are we going to get that naturally, or do we have to do some sort of stimulus package to reach there? That's an open question and something we're about to find out.
Question to the left. Senator Taylor, sorry.
That's okay. Thank you, Chair Haas. Just going back to the comment about with the tax cuts and juicing the economy and et cetera, and I understand what you're saying about what the literature suggests is, you know, the positive aspects of that. I would just like to know whether or not you would concur that there's also a possibility that some companies may not necessarily either completely invest or invest at the same level as what the literature would suggest, and perhaps just be keeping that profit. And that would show through an increase in share prices, depending on, I think that it's time will tell, and it'll be interesting to see how different companies play out. But I think one of the things that folks are concerned about is that this tax cut occurred, and some people will just be benefiting from it significantly more than others. And so, not that you had anything to do with that, but I just wondered if you could comment on that, please.
Yeah. Chair Haas, Senator Taylor, absolutely. I think one of the clearest analysis that I've seen was came from Morgan Stanley, and they said basically, roughly speaking, about half of the tax savings for corporations will go to dividends and stock buybacks. Maybe a third of it will go to more investment, and then the remaining 15% or so will go to workers, right? Right. That's their kind of the ballpark analysis that they ended up with in terms of where some of this money will ultimately flow. That's just one firm's analysis. But something along those lines, I think, is what a lot of people are coming up with, is that we definitely will see some dividends, and that'll filter into the revenue impact, too.
So the timing isn't perfect here. In particular, in terms of firms now, you give them more access to more cash, will they necessarily invest it? Well, where we are right now in the business cycle, most firms are pretty profitable and are sitting on quite a bit of cash. And so, again, the timing isn't perfect. But that said, I don't, to be fair to the proponents of the tax reform, timing isn't everything. I think this was the time they could pass a big tax package. And so to be fair again, the models you see here aren't really appropriate for making a business case for the tax plan. Even the Council of Economic Advisors on the bottom there get 3-5% long-term increase in output isn't much, given that they did their study by cherry-picking different coefficients from all of these other studies to make the biggest number, but that's still not a big number. But that's not the way to make the case, because our traditional models don't show what they're looking for. We're talking about our models show changes at the margin, small changes in taxes and how people are going to react to that. The business case for the tax cuts would be, we're not making a change at the margin, we're making a sea change here in terms of going from a high tax country to a low tax country, and maybe 5, 10, 20 years from now, we'll see different business decisions on it that aren't really reflected in any of the data we have about the world to date.
Can I ask you, are there economic benefits to stock buybacks? That's where half the tax cut, corporate tax cut. Does that benefit the economy?
Absolutely, Senator Haas. It benefits shareholders, and shareholders can be businesses or households or the like. But the way we're going to see it through our tax system would be share buybacks increase share prices and therefore create taxable capital gains for some entities, mm-hmm. which is wealth and. Which creates more economic spending and the like.
Thank you.
Well, if I could, of that, thank you. Of that, the part that benefits ordinary folks are the parts that go into pension accounts, and allow increase in stock value that way. But the rest goes into high income, high wealth individuals for the most part, doesn't it?
And invest.
Yes, Senator Barnhart, the concentration of equities is skewed towards high-income individuals. That's true. But as you say, everybody has some. Most people have some mutual fund or some exposure.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead.
All right, thanks. So, in terms of the economics, we don't have a sea change model developed to try to show a big impact of this. So we're going with the consensus, which would be a little more growth in the near term, maybe a little bit less as we go farther out. So, well, what about taxpayers' responses then? What about tax planners and the like, and what are they going to do in terms of strategies to adapt, and how does that affect our revenues? Well, we can't go through all the myriad of issues here, because for every provision, there are some potential strategies for some taxpayers that might be reasonable. But we will look at some of these things that are of particular importance to the forecast, and at least in terms of the assumptions that we've built in. So the first, we've already spoken a little bit already, shifting across tax years, where we are seeing a tremendous amount of advanced corporate payments, estimated personal income tax payments, and withholdings all at the end of tax year 2017. So either taking advantage of tax breaks that are going to expire, or trying to pull costs forward, push income out to when rates are lower. So some of that's going on, and again, the trick there is to try to differentiate what's real and what's Memorex, what's actually showing more liability or growth in the economy, and what is just intertemporal shifting and the like over time. The next one is the tricky one, and there are all kinds of different strategies that accountants are now talking about to try to take advantage of the new rules of the game, the different rate structures that are out there. In particular, now we have caps on the deductibility of income taxes paid by individuals. And so, workers or investors then might want to not be workers and investors anymore, but rather as businesses to avoid those things. Similarly, we have lower rates on C corporations and some changes in their deductions. We have a deductibility of pass-through entities. So there, for different case studies, you could make a case for some businesses wanting to shift from being C corporations to pass-through entities like partnerships or sole proprietorships or S-corps or the like, or the other way around, vice versa. So those are things that are out there. In general, the accounts we talked to so far, there are anecdotes, but for the most part are saying that they don't see any one of these that's a huge incentive, that would be a huge driving force yet for most of their clients. But that said, we're not going to know for a while. These accounts are going to go through, particularly their corporate clients, over the next year with their tax, when their tax year comes up. And for these clients, they're going to try things different ways. They're going to experiment with trying, to file in different ways and which way is going to save the most money. So as the practitioners do this experimentation, hopefully we'll start to get some better information on where the real incentives to change are, because there are a lot of moving parts. And finally, there's a secondary impact that I want to mention, because it's one of the largest ones that we've actually assumed in the revenue forecast, and that has to do with the second order effect of this repatriated income for multinationals yet again. Here we go with this most very uncertain, but potentially a very large impact, which serves to very much mute some of these negative numbers and the statics that we see in that very first year. So what do I mean by this? Well, so what will multinational corporations do with this repatriated income once they bring it home? Okay, so they have all this old income sitting overseas. They bring it home, and they go ahead and they pay their federal taxes on it, and they pay state taxes to 46 out of the 47 states that has a corporate income tax, except for us, where we have this double deduction or whatever. So we're left out of that. But so they pay all their taxes, and then they've got some money left over, and now it's here in America. Well, what are they going to do with that money? Right? Are they going to continue to sit on it like they were doing before, now it's here instead of in Ireland or on some Caribbean island? Or are they going to reinvest it in a factory here, or maybe a factory in Chile, or into their own business? Or maybe they're going to pay it out to shareholders, either giving them dividends or, again, these stock buybacks. And that's where it moves the needle, and particularly for our economic, for our revenue forecast, is, well, how much of this second-order impact is going to get show up as individuals in terms of income. And in 2004, last time we had a repatriation holiday, about 60% of it ended up going to individuals and turning into individual tax liability. So this is a pretty big plus. Almost, you know, on order scale of the negative $80 million that we're seeing the corporate direct hit from the repatriated income create. Now, to be clear, this doesn't affect the debate over Senate Bill 1529. Those revenue impacts are not affected by this. Whether or not Oregon has a double deduction or not, is not going to affect the amount of money that these national firms are going to give out to their shareholders. So this stuff is beyond the legislative impact here. So this isn't changing anything in terms of the policy debate, but it certainly does turn into this second order dynamic positive in the first year, helping to offset some of these static negatives in our aggregate outlook.
Representative Marsh.
Thank you, Chair. Before we leave this slide, I want to pin you down on what is in a while. You noted that many of these impacts we're not going to know for a while. So we know this year we're going to make some immediate changes just to get through this year. When we come back here in 2019, can we expect to kind of have a baseline of information so we can continue the work of really doing the adjustments that we need in Oregon based on what's happened at the out of the federal tax reform?
Yeah, Representative Marsh, I think that's when we first start getting data will be the early corporate filers in 2019 are going to be reflecting the 2018 tax law and the 2018 income. Then for the personal income taxes, of course, a lot of folks file in April. The big movers and shakers don't find out their tax returns until they amend them in the fall. So really, we'll finally have some kind of good handle, or we'll never have a good handle, but we'll have some data to work with. As of the fall of 2019, we should have a fairly decent first observation for most firms and households.
The fall of 2019.
That's right, because April of 2019 is when the taxes are due for individuals. For corporations, it'll be spread across the year. But for individuals, it'll be April of 2019. But then again, that's just when you have to pay our high income households then end up filing and amending and do their extensions until the fall. And that's where we're going to see a lot of this investment income and all that show up. So, unfortunately, with quite a bit of a delay.
It is in a while.
Yeah.
Almost years.
Yeah. 21.
Okay, so here's an illustration of this surge in estimated personal income tax payments that we've seen here in Oregon. And this one messes with our forecast process. For most part, estimated payments in Oregon are pretty easy to model because they follow very closely tax liability of the year before. It makes sense because we have these safe harbor provisions where taxpayers are held harmless. As long as you pay what you owed last year, we won't penalize you, right? But, so you for not paying enough. And so a lot of times, so this is creates a gravity for accountants and filers to pay pretty much what they owed last year. That's true all except for the very last year-end payment of a year, where we start to see people anticipate what they're going to owe in April and start to reconcile that. And so this was an epiphany I had a couple, 3 years ago, and how do we forecast the hardest thing for us, which is all these non-wage investment incomes taxpayers get to choose when they realize for tax purposes, and it really moves the needle where we get these big April surprises in terms of payments or lack thereof or refunds. And so I landed on this as my my best leading indicator is what's happening to these December, January estimated payments. So, just at the very end of the year, what are accountants and filers doing? And if you see here in general, I mean, it's not a one-to-one transformation, but pretty close. When you have a big year in growth in those estimated payments, you'll get a big year of growth in this non-wage, non-retirement type of income. And in general, then, when you look at the share of those estimated payments to that non-wage income, boy, for the last almost 10 years, it's been anchored right there around 2.1%, 1.9%. So this is great. You know, this was a great way that we could get a forward look. But this year, not looking so good in terms of a leading indicator. Our December, January estimated payments that are directed for 2017 liability increased by almost 42% there, okay. And which is clearly not all fundamental. There's some, particularly since all the other states are seeing similar results, and some even vastly more than we are. Like I say, some of the New York and some of the other states are seeing even quite a bit more than we are, and so here comes the question, you know, to what extent does this reflect underlying liability? And if it does reflect underlying liability, is that just taxpayers shifting it between tax years, or is it fundamentally more growth or fundamentally more income that they've earned in 2017?
Questions?
Pressure, Senator Burchaker.
Whether it's shifting or not, we're going to have more money because of it, correct?
Oh, not necessarily, Senator Bartringer. The idea being, well, if we take money out of the second fiscal year and move it into the first fiscal year of the biennium, from a budget standpoint, we might be just the same, right? You know, to the extent that we're just saying, okay, we're going to now have it in fiscal year 18 instead of fiscal year 19. Strong today means a weak tomorrow. No, not necessarily. But if it's because the economy's bigger and we have more profitable firms and more highly paid workers and the like, well, that you would expect to carry forward. So it is an open question.
Just to follow up, I mean, I personally, having been in business for quite some time, had at least three, maybe four different former CPAs send me emails at least twice before the end of the year saying, because of SALT, go pay more, go pay more, go pay more. And of course, as you know, in Oregon, it doesn't count. Right. And so I had, you know, probably six or eight emails and watched the news and said, go pay more on your estimated taxes. And of course, I did not, because I'm not in business like that anymore. But if had I followed my CPA's advantage, I'd be getting this big refund back because it didn't matter in Oregon. So I don't know how that plays out. Senator Burchaker.
Yes, just to kind of tag along on what prepaying state taxes does, though, it reduces your tax liability on your federal tax return. And so I think that's why you've done that.
If you're allowed.
That's right. But it may well be that people are expecting a benefit that they're not going to get. And so prepaying today doesn't help you at all if it ends up just not changing your underlying liability over time. This is, your guys are floating around what I call the Lehner theory, which is that Oregonians are just too stupid to file their taxes properly.
For the record, I did not use that language.
I'll see you in the paper tomorrow.
Probably gonna show up in the
for the record, you're the most quoted economist in the state. So.
That's right.
So here we go. We're seeing the same sort of thing, like I said, in corporate advance payments. I didn't put that chart up. But we are seeing a similar thing in terms of wage growth, of withholdings out of income. Now, typically, here you see growth in withholdings versus growth in wages from our employment surveys. And typically, these are darn close together. The only time they've been separated, you see a big separation in 07 and 2010. That had to do with changing our withholding tables. So we had different withholdings versus the underlying labor market. But you know, the only time you typically see this is in a time like now when anecdotally we're getting a lot of bonus payments and the like. In the 1990s was the classic example of this, where firms were loving using bonuses and stock options instead of paying wages and compensation. And then after the tech bubble burst, that became less attractive as a strategy. But we're certainly seeing it now, where withholding is growing twice as fast as these underlying wages in recent months, you know, far beyond what our labor market could support or our labor market performance could support. So there's some more of this shifting going on across different, again, across different tax instruments. So the toughest stuff for us to get a hold of are these potential changes in filing status. We mentioned before that although none of these is really screaming like a red flag to the accountants we talked to, nevertheless, you know, there's a strategy for almost every policy change that people are saying are possible to be out there, you know, possible avenues. One thing a lot of folks are talking about are workers turning wages into business income. You know, wages now are potentially taxed at that top rate of 37.5% with a capped state and local tax deduction. And so, well, maybe we can get around these things by either becoming a contractor, you know, or a sole proprietor rather than an employee, where now I don't face these limits and I'm taxed with this pass-through deduction. Or maybe becoming you incorporated, a corporation where I say, okay, well, now I'm only taxed at 21% if instead of wages, it's corporate profits. At some point, I have to take that back out down the road, but maybe it's when I'm taxed at a lower rate rather than this 37.5% when I'm retired, or there are other strategies, Roth IRAs, step-ups in capital gains, ways that maybe the 21 plus the next tax rate is still below what you're the top rate in income. And the like. Then there are examples of maybe C corps could become pass-throughs because C corps have lost some of their deductibility. Maybe pass-throughs can change so that they're not subject to the limits on high incomes or service businesses by saying, "Oh, well, I'm not a service business entirely. I'm going to break off the building I work in or the payroll services and call that a different business so I can keep the income in my core business down." Or stuffing personal investments in a business. Again, with a top rate of 37.5%, maybe it's best to house your investments in a company or a pass-through entity. Where this is really going to hit the forecast, or one of the places, is in our forecast for corporate profits. For several rounds now, we've been wrong on our corporate profit forecast, expecting that profits as a share of GDP would come back down to earth over time. As the economy's expanding, wages are going up, interest rates are going up, the cost side, this is the typical time in the cycle where you see profitability erode. We're just starting to see that, but expect more to happen. But should we see a mass shift into C corporations, this could reverse these expectations. So finally, we'll quickly go through the other big impact. Now that we've talked about what we're doing in terms of the tax reform, which is taking these static estimates, but then with the dynamic stuff watering down that first year quite a bit, what about equity markets? And we've seen this real sharp correction in recent weeks, which has the potential to really move the needle on the revenue forecast.
This first chart comes from Tim Dewey at the University of Oregon, and some of you may know, he's one of the leading Fed watchers around the nation in terms of what's the Federal Reserve going to do in terms of what are the speeches they're giving, what data are they tracking, the outlook for near-term interest rates and the economy. And what this chart tries to show you is that the chart begins when the Fed starts raising interest rates in any given business cycle, right? So from the time they start hiking interest rates, what happens to the stock market using the S&P 500 in this case? And the answer is the asset prices continue to go up even as the Fed's tightening, right? The asset valuations are tied to, you know, profits and expectations of future profits for these companies, which are doing better in a growing economy, and overall asset markets are increasing. And what you see in the red line, which is the current market, at least as of Sunday night or Monday morning when he last put this updated this chart, you know, they were continuing to increase in line with previous cycles, except in the fall we started to see a big acceleration in the stock market. And then that all came out in the last couple of weeks, and it's kind of reverted back to trend of what we've seen in past asset cycles. So the biggest takeaway here from a economic perspective and Federal Reserve perspective is that the Fed's baseline outlook remains intact. We're getting firming wage growth, better inflation numbers. We're getting ongoing economic growth, and the Fed has been signaling they're going to hike 3, maybe 4 times this year for interest rates. But the financial markets have been underpricing in interest rate hikes. They've been expecting more like 2 interest rate hikes. And so we've got this flow of data. We now have showing better economic numbers, and we have the potential impact of the legislation to bump up growth even more in the near term. And so this, you can tell a coherent story where the market is repricing in interest rate expectations, and that the Federal Reserve is very serious about raising rates 3 or 4 times this year, and that has led to the stock market correction. And so from the economic perspective, the Fed's baseline remains unchanged. They're not likely to stop hiking interest rates because we've seen a minor correction in the stock market, because they believed, and the president of the San Francisco Federal Reserve said that, you know, it was very clear that asset markets had gotten out of line in recent months, and this just brings us back to where we think they should be. So that's the Fed's thinking in terms of maybe how the stock market correction will flow through to monetary policy. But so far, the Federal Reserve thinks we're on track.
Which is good, which means maybe we won't realize the worst possible stock market correction, because big ones can be really bad for our budget. But it doesn't necessarily mean we're going to necessarily have a big one. Here I've put for the last 30 years, anytime we saw the stock market correct by a value of 10% or more, which is what we saw in just the matter of a couple, 3 days earlier in the month. So this one would be just as fast as anyone, even quite a bit faster than anyone we've seen before. But to read this chart, we start at 100% when we're at the very peak of the stock market cycle. And then as you drop, that indicates losses. So the November 15th dark black line lost about 10%. In November of 2015, scared me, and I did. I recycled and cut and pasted some of the stuff I wrote then for the report today. But nevertheless, that turned right back around, no problem. Quick response, not too much of a damage. But you can see others have been considerably more. So we're at a little bit of a loss here because our vendor has not factored in the stock market forecast, which is something I like to keep at arm's length, 3,000 miles away. But at the same time, to get out in front of this, we had to make some assumptions. What is in the forecast right now is about a combination between that November 15th best case scenario and the June of 1990 return. So what we're talking about there, even though it's not much of a movement in stock prices, or at least not for very long, is still a pretty darn big revenue hit, because unfortunately these stock market sensitive types of revenues, in particular capital gains, are even much more volatile than the stock market itself. Right, you see the big one, the October 07 downturn, where the stock market lost half of its value. The hits here for Orion capital gains were even more. It went from almost $10 billion to $2 billion over this same time period. And so these great swings are of concern. So if we take a mild downturn like I am assuming here, we're looking at about still a hit of about $100 million a year in the out years. But the timing is a little tricky. Because with these stock market downturns, at first it doesn't hurt our revenues. In fact, it helps it temporarily, because as we're seeing a correction, a bunch of stockholders are cashing in their gains. Right. Sometimes they've held stocks for quite a while, and so okay. so as prices start to go down, they cash in these gains, and it artificially holds up state revenues and taxable liability for a while. But then, once that's gone and those gains start to turn more and more to actual capital losses, then the bottom drops out. And so this timing is the tricky part. And that's why it's hard to make these and why I took a more modest stock market forecast, because it's hard to bet on this timing. Here you see the growth differential in our realized capital gains versus stock prices. A little bit apples to oranges, because the capital gains are tax years and the stock prices are through December 31st, which is what is reflected in the tax year. But nevertheless, you see really big changes. When it's 20 percentage points difference, that means if the stock prices are growing at 10%, the capital gains are growing at 30. So, for example, here in the big Great Recession, October of 07, so in that year, tax year of 07 was relatively flat in terms of the equity prices. For the average for that year, we're only up about 1%, but our capital gains were up 26%. And then in the downturn, it was even more pronounced. The downturn in terms of prices in that first year was only a 6% correction, but yet our capital gains revenues fell by 60%. And so it's these real swings that have us a little bit traumatized and just want to articulate the uncertainty as we go forward, as we take a look at where the prices evolve from here.
Representative Restwell, did you have a question?
I did. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you translate that then into revenues for 17, 18, and 19? Just what you said about the first year being we're up because people are cashing in, and then out years being down, just so we know how to budget.
Yes, Senator Hass, Representative Raske. Yeah, that's a very good question. So this one is a little different than all the others insofar as right now the correction started in February or January, the very beginning of the tax year. As you notice all these other downturns, July was the earliest, and typically it's in the fall. And so for the outlook, we didn't get quite as much of a bump in this first biennium, or in particular this first, the tax year 2018, which is going to come in April of 2019. It's relatively flat or unchanged. But then in those future years, like I say, we're looking at about a hit of about $100 million a year, which reflects about a 10% shaving in the equity markets.
Thank you.
So bottom line, sorry about going over time. Here's here's what happened to the revenue outlook. We do have a little bit of an increase over the general fund and lottery resource outlook relative to the last forecast. A couple things to be said here. Some of this is one-time revenues, which aren't included in the kicker, and also some of those are lottery revenues reflecting a lot of this growth, which are also not reflected in the kicker. In terms of the personal income tax kicker base, right now our forecast is almost spot on with what the close of session was, about $37 million higher than the close of session. But in terms of resources, since we have additional lottery funds and additional one-time resources, we are a little bit higher than at that time. Decomposing the current fiscal year, again, there are all so many moving parts with federal tax law changes knocking it down, stock market downturn knocking it down, at least in the second fiscal year of the biennium a little bit. But yet we have recent collections strong, and lottery revenues still continue to come in faster than we expected, and in particular the declines that were forecast following the opening of the tribal casino up north have yet to fully materialize. So in general, we have about, from the revenue side, about an unchanged forecast, a little bit down on the traditional general fund revenues over the biennium here. You have $40 million down in the gross general fund revenues, but that's largely offset by 2023-29 increase in the lottery revenue. So from a revenue side, that's pretty much unchanged. There is an increase in available resources. We get about $100 million in one-time resources as the accountants cleared up the year in December. They have to put the books to bed for the previous fiscal year. That brought about $100 million. The biggest part of that is our fund sweeps, our reversions, unspent general fund dollars. The legislature allocated dollars in 15-17 that weren't spent by agencies. Those have just been recovered by the general fund, and so that's the largest part of this. Up to about $70 million of this is one-time revenues associated with those. So what's net in terms of the revenue side of it? 17-19 on net, down 10%, I mean $10 million, largely due to this corporate tax hit, which again is the repatriation piece and the accelerated depreciation piece mostly. And then in future tax years, we're down by more. Largely due to these big negative blue lot bars, which are personal income taxes, which is reflective mostly of the stock market correction there. So that's where we're getting. So right up front, a lot of it has to do with the tax law, and then as we go forward, that personal income drag from the equity market corrections start to bite. Then in later years, as we start to see the expiring individual provisions and the like and the tax law, we do start to see positive overall revenue impacts.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Going back to this slide.
What number is that?
I'm trying to figure out how to actually ask this question. My guess is, and you tell me if I'm right, that your estimates this time have less certainty because of all the moving parts that you've already described than they would normally. And normally your estimates are uncertain based on things that might happen that we don't know about yet.
Absolutely, Representative. They are always extremely uncertain. This is even taking it to another level, I think. But luckily, we have the Legislative Revenue Office and the Department of Revenue who are holding our hands through the process and helping us as well as much as we can.
If I could follow up. So you're actually predicting then that the stock market correction we just had is going to have this kind of out-year effect? Did I understand that correctly, or were you trying to say something else?
Yeah, it's about about $100 million a year as I forecast it right now in terms of a drag from the market correction.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Senator Boquist.
And just briefly, I mean, you don't need to go back to the slide, but that is could be compounded by both Global Insights, IHC, whatever they call themselves, and Moody's on their slides, both forecasted in their different levels of market corrections. The Moody's was out, I think, maybe 3 years and 3 or 4 years, and then the just slightly dip on IHA. So they're actually in line with you in these same forecasts right here.
Yeah, that's good to hear, Senator Boquist. But again, timing is everything. It's just that since we had this really bad week, wanted to try to get a little
we
bit
had
of
one
that
too.
Got a question.
She's first.
Representative.
Thank you,
Smith-Warren.
Mr. Chair. Just going back to that again, so that is your projected impact based on that correction, even though indeed the market has gone back to where it was before.
Oh, Representative Smith-Warner, it some of the losses have been recovered. We're back to about where we started the year now. Mm-hmm. But not the 10% anymore. So hopefully, like I say, we're on path for this November 2015 scare, which turned out to be only a very small revenue event because the market corrected within the year.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. First of all, gentlemen, thank you for being here. Appreciate your perspective and your wisdom on this issue. I guess I just want to share for the record for this committee,
I'm nervous. And I go back to Senator Morse in the Corvallis area, who reminded us that during times like this, we need to be preparing for those downturns. And Republicans need to remember that as they continue to push their priorities, there's dollars associated with them. And those in the majority party need to remember as they push their priorities, there's dollars associated with them. Mm-hmm. And this comes from the vice co-chair of Ways and Means, who has done this now for 18 years. Mm-hmm. And so while today we're up approximately $100 million okay. after the information that's been shared with us, keep in mind the future is uncertain, as was also just shared with us, and we have many priorities that we're going to want to continue to fund in the future. And so we either, in my view, we have two options. Either one, we have a real conversation about revenue reform, or two, we have a real conversation about controlling spending. But one of those conversations has to occur, because being at $100 million up, it's going to be very easy for us to be $2 billion down in the near future.
Thank you, Representative Smith. That's a great segue. And for one, this one-time revenues are one-time revenues. And so what we're seeing today will do nothing to alleviate this expected structural budget gap that we're going to see in the coming biennia. So that budget cap is still there. It's real. This report changes that not at all. And the other issue about risk is a very important one, and because right now we're starting to get, although for the most part, in terms of recessionary risk, which is the big thing that, you know, could crater our, crater's not a verb, but to that could hit our revenues would be, of course, a nationwide recession. And although the vast majority of economic indicators are still pointing in the right direction, and most forecasters are pretty sanguine about that near-term risk, I would say that there's more risk there than there was a year ago. Why? Because now we're starting to see this narrative out there about a traditional pathway to a recession, that with stimulating a already full employment economy, we might overheat the economy, lead the Federal Reserve to increase interest rates either out of the fear of inflation or in order to get a cushion for that next recession, make the monetary policy mistake, take the gas out of the equity markets, and then you see a decline there. And so we're starting to see people talk about this pretty coordinated, traditional recessionary dynamic that they're starting to observe something that looks kind of like that. And so in that environment, if we were to get a negative shock that were to, coordinate everybody's pessimism at once, that's how recessions happen. When firms and workers both become pessimistic all at once. So what can we do about that? We can't make everyone happier or more optimistic, but we can save, and which Oregon has certainly been doing more so than ever before. Here is our traditional Oregon budgetary reserves. We're now up over around 8% of a biennial budget, which is as well as we've ever done, but nevertheless would not be enough to offset a recession in and of itself. But if our growth continues, so will these reserve funds until around 2023-24, when we hit the cap on our education stability fund, which is 5% of the prior year biennial's expenditures.
But if you can't do tax reform to deal with the volatility, and the next best thing is having strong reserves, and these are as good as anybody up here seen, and we didn't have these in the last two recessions, and that's
right.
Why that downturn turned into a train wreck for Oregon. This is really good.
Absolutely. Most of this can be traced directly to this,
that'll be
this
the
committee.
This is really good.
These were automatic stabilizers that were put in.
That's right.
The Education Stability Fund, these automatic deposits come out of lottery money, and the Rainy Day Fund gets some out of the ending balance and out of the Measure 67 reforms that this committee made sure that some of that was put away.
Yeah. And just to I guess, emphasize the silver lining here. This was not a short-term fix. That Education Stability Fund was passed in 2002. Yeah, 2002. And, you know, these take a while. And so points for long-term thoughtful thinking. Rep. Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree with everything that you said about the reserve accounts. We've been struggling for a long time to get that done. Our co-chairs deserve a lot of credit, as do other many other members over years to for this policy. The wet blanket, unfortunately, that I throw on this is that, as I understand, our structural deficit in 19 and 21 exceeds the total amount of the reserves. So you're absolutely correct about the cushioning effect. On the other hand, the next legislature and the one after that are going to have to make some very, very significant decisions. I really appreciate Representative Smith's comments, but I think he understands the issue pretty well.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, Senator Buckles. I just want to thank Mark and Josh for making the presentation and look forward to meeting with you next week and going into diving into detail so we can start on the structural issues that Representative Barnhart has raised.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Thanks to the House members. With no other action or activity before us, the Senate committee is adjourned.